Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from the UPS Store, offering services from shredding to printing to mailboxing. And instead of closing this holiday, the UPS Store is doing another ing altogether. Opening the UPS Store, every ing for small business, and of course, shipping.
This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington, filling in for Joshua Johnson. Here's the scene outside of an Amazon warehouse in California. We'll take you there now. Jubilant yesterday after a major announcement.
We are also establishing a new Amazon minimum wage of $15 an hour.
That round of applause from workers was for Dave Clark. He's Amazon's senior vice president of operations, and he was informing staff of the online retail giant's major change in policy. Minimum wage earners will see their pay jump to $15 an hour starting in November. It's a move that will increase the wages of 350,000 people, 40% of Amazon's workforce. Amazon is a leader in the business world. Its motives are something for us to discuss, but can we expect other big companies to follow suit given the size of Amazon's footprint? And anyway, in today's economy, is $15 an hour actually enough? We'll get to all of that right after you hear this.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Grow with Google. Digital skills are becoming more and more important in today's economy. That's why Grow with Google is providing free online training and tools to help Americans learn the skills they need to succeed. Learn more about Grow with Google and get started by visiting google.com/grow.
You've certainly heard some variation of the phrase, be a man.
Are you a real man?
You must be gay.
Man up. Manhood is something that's hard to earn and easy to lose.
Masculinity threats, this week on Hidden Brain.
Man up, man up. Gay.
A woman's job, a woman's job, a woman's job.
Joining me from Sacramento, California is Ashan Hightower, a minimum wage worker and a Fight for 15 advocate. Ashan, welcome to 1A.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Ashan, you don't work at Amazon, but your grassroots movement, Fight for 15, started in 2012, I think can take quite a good deal of the credit for Amazon's decision here. What was your reaction to Amazon's announcement yesterday?
I was very excited when I seen it on the news yesterday morning. It's a milestone, and I hope it sets a fire for under some of the big wigs to set an example that we need $15 here also as fast food workers.
Now, I want to talk about $15, and I want to talk about real life, Ashan. You mentioned that you're a fast food worker. You're a senior manager at Burger King, right?
Yes, correct.
And what is your hourly wage currently?
I make $11.50 an hour.
And benefits?
Right now, we do not have any benefits.
So no health care, no retirement, no pension, $11.50 an hour. You're a single parent with two teenage daughters. Can you give me a sense of how far $11.50 an hour goes for you, for fueling up your car, for taking care of your kids?
$11.50 an hour goes nowhere. You know, I'm living check to check. It's a struggle. You know, living paycheck to paycheck, robbing Peter to pay Paul, trying to figure out how I'm going to do things and how to make the money stretch. You know, $11.50 goes nowhere in today's society.
What does the end of the month look like? You know, when you have the electric bill, the water bill, one of the kids needs new sneakers, I'm sure, and it might be nice to maybe go to a movie. What does the end of the month typically look like for you?
The end of the month is very hard. You know, food gets low around the end of the month. Funds are low, and I'm penny pinching. I'm just waiting on the next check.
Now, California is one of the states that has a $15 minimum wage scheduled for 2022, so a couple of years away, sort of a transition period. What will those extra dollars mean for you, Ashan?
Those extra dollars would mean a great amount to me. It's an extra bill paid. It's a sport program or activity I can pay for my child. You know, any little increase of wage helps my, you know, my income drastically.
And $15 an hour for your life and your kids, would that mean a living wage for you? Could you get by in your household on 15?
I would be able to live a lot more comfortably, but as in, you know, being where I want to be and being able to afford all the necessities that I want to, $15 still isn't quite enough.
Well, we're going to be talking about
single parent.
Well, it's exactly what we're going to be talking about for the remainder of the show. Sean Hightower, before I let you go, a question about Burger King. Do you have any doubt that they can afford it, $15 an hour for you and your coworkers there?
Oh, yeah, they can afford it. They have the money.
Are you sure?
Yeah, they have the money and the needs.
And the needs for workers, right?
Yeah, they have the needs for workers, just like they have the needs to continually hire and to do upgrades to our businesses. I mean, they need to upgrade their employees. So that's one reason why, you know, the fight for 15, we're fighting for unions, because we need someone to have a bargaining tool for us, someone to hear our voice, because right now they're just looking past us and our voices are not being heard.
Well, Sean Hightower, you are part of the Fight for 15. It's a movement that Americans have been hearing more and more about over the last several years since 2012. And now a major company, Amazon.com, announces that they will go to 15. Your state of California is going to 15. Several cities across the country have gone to 15, and in some cases higher in one or two cases. We're going to talk about that, too. Sean Hightower, I want to thank you for joining us. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. The pleasure's all mine.
Well, we want to expand this discussion on minimum wage and living wage across America, not only Amazon and their gigantic footprint in the economy, but what it means for workers in other positions at the low end of the American pay scale, especially as income inequality is worse maybe than it's ever been, certainly since the Gilded Age. Joining me from an NPR studio in New York is Paul Sahn, the State Policy Program Director at the National Employment Law Project. Paul, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
And here in studio with me is Michael Saltzman. He's Managing Director of the Employment Policies Institute. Michael, thanks for being here.
Thanks.
And also in studio with me, Sarah Anderson, the Director of the Global Economy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and co-editor for Inequality.com. Sarah, great to have you.
Nice to be here.
Paul, let me start with you. What did you think of Amazon's announcement yesterday? More money for 350,000 workers at a minimum. A step in the right direction?
Definitely. It shows that profitable, cost-competitive companies can pay a $15 minimum wage, and really shines a spotlight on the other big low-wage chains like Walmart, McDonald's, and Ms. Hightower's employer, Burger King, to join them. And Amazon's just the latest in a series of major companies that have agreed to raise pay to $15 an hour after demands from their workers. Target did the same last year, and Disney just agreed to a $15 wage for its resort workers in Florida and California after a long campaign. You know, as you noted, it really shows the power of the Fight for 15, launched back in 2012 by the striking fast food workers, which has transformed our national conversation and policy landscape around low pay and what workers can expect from their employers. And for Amazon, it came as the company's come under increasing scrutiny for its employment practices. You know, there's been the focus on how, you know, a huge portion of its workforce earns so little money they have to rely on food stamps and safety net programs at taxpayer expense to get by. But in a lot of ways, the challenge for Amazon will really be what it does next, because pay is just sort of part of what the question's been with them. There have been a lot of business press attention focused on the harsh health and safety conditions facing their warehouse and delivery workers. There's a strike right now in Southern California by warehouse and trucking workers that serve Amazon and other companies. There have been complaints at Whole Foods after the acquisition by Amazon that pay has gotten worse. And there's really a lot of challenging workforce issues. And really, I think that the next question for Amazon is how it brings its, you know, creative, disruptive power to delivering, you know, good jobs for its workforce. You know, and the $15 minimum wage is really an important first step. But there are a lot of serious challenges facing the Amazon workforce
now,
right now.
Michael Saltzman, you take, I think, more of a pro-business point of view at the Employment Policies Institute. You say that Amazon got it half right. What do you mean?
Yeah, well, there were sort of two parts of Amazon's announcement. The first part was that Amazon is raising its minimum wage, which is news in a sense because it's Amazon, but it's actually not abnormal right now. I mean, there was a remarkable even article in the Wall Street Journal this morning that talked about companies around the country, even in states that are at the federal minimum wage. And there was a distribution center in Louisville, Kentucky that was offering 10 to 15% raises in bonuses. They're giving away iPads to try and attract workers. So I think a lot of this is a symptom of a tight labor market right now. And I welcome the announcement because I actually view it as proof, just like announcements in the past by Target, by Walmart, by McDonald's, by Costco, that a government mandate is not necessary in order for employees to receive a raise. And in fact, if you sort of look at the history over the last 20 or 30 years, there have been a couple of studies that have shown that it's very common for a minimum wage worker to get a raise within 1 to 12 months on the job. So I think the part of the announcement that I was less enthusiastic about was Amazon's decision that they're going to go lobby for an increase in the federal minimum wage, which I think is going to put their competitors who don't have a huge market cap at a disadvantage.
Now, you mentioned what might happen when Amazon lobbies at the federal level. They'll be talking to senators. Senator Bernie Sanders has enjoyed putting a lot of pressure on Amazon and other employers. He's accused them of being free riders in the economy. Here's Bernie Sanders talking about Amazon yesterday.
What Mr. Bezos today has done is not only enormously important for Amazon's hundreds of thousands of employees, it could well be, and I think it will be, a shot heard around the world. Mr. Bezos and Amazon are now leading the way.
Sarah Anderson, Bernie Sanders says this 15 is great, but this is about the pressure it will put on other big companies.
I would go even further than Senator Sanders and say that Amazon's announcement should inspire people working on many other social justice issues, from the Black Lives Matter movement to the fight over the Supreme Court. This was a reminder that people power combined with bold, passionate political leadership can make a real difference. And in this case, it was the fight for 15, allied with Senator Sanders, who really just kind of sunk his teeth into the ankle of the Amazon CEO and just would not let go. And as recently as 2 weeks ago, they were accusing him of being misleading and trying to swat him away. And so their dramatic turnaround on this wage issue should be inspiring and will create massive ripple effects.
We've been hearing from so many of you. Elizabeth tweets, why is the minimum wage a specific amount instead of a percentage tied to cost of living or some other figure measured and adjusted annually? And Will emails us from Cape Cod. I have a small landscaping and gardening business with, depending on the time of year, 6 to 10 employees, all skilled gardeners. I pay at least $18 an hour and I support a higher minimum wage. Well, we're going to be talking about a minimum wage and a living wage. Let's have Paul Son set the table for us a little bit. Paul, the federal minimum wage is just $7.25, less than half of what Amazon is paying and what you can make in California starting in 2022. Hasn't been raised by Congress since 2009, and it's lost 10% of its purchasing power even since 2009. How many states hew to the $7.25 federal minimum?
There are about 21 states where the minimum wage is just $7.25, and then there's another group of about 8 states where it's the minimum wage is a little higher but still low, $9 or lower. There's other 21 states have stopped waiting for Congress to act and have raised the minimum wage, including a whole cluster of them that are raising it significantly to the $12 to $15 an hour range. One of the key things on the minimum wage to understand is, it's been because of the role of money in politics and, the congressional Republican leadership's refusal to allow any action on it. It's really become irrelevant at the federal level. It's so low, it's not doing its job of raising pay. And this is a real issue right now, it's receiving increasing attention. We're in a booming economy, jobs are growing, but there's almost no wage growth. Jobs are barely keeping up with the rising cost of living. The one place where we're seeing wage growth for workers at the bottom are in those states that are raising the minimum wage. And that actually speaks to the important point that Mr. Salzman and the caller raised about, hey, if some companies are raising pay, do we need a minimum wage? But the data shows that while there are some leaders, to really raise the floor and improve pay in our economy, we need fair standards, and the minimum wage has to be a lot higher. And the you know, things have gotten so out of whack that today close to one in three Americans earns less than $15 an hour. That's, 40 million workers. The median age is 35. You know, these are overwhelmingly adults who spend their careers in these jobs. And it's fast food, but not just fast food. It's jobs, you know, the jobs that make our economy run. About, you know, one in four healthcare workers, one in five educators, you know, huge swaths of our economy, of our workforce are stuck in these jobs paying less than $15 an hour.
And Paul, I think it says a lot when you say that the minimum wage as laid down by Congress is almost irrelevant to the real economy because $7.25 just doesn't go anywhere in most states and most localities. And yet to have Congress advocating laws that are essentially irrelevant to how people really live is a remarkable and notable state of affairs. Now, Sarah, you're a proponent of a living wage. And I read that tweet from one of our listeners who said, why have a minimum wage? Why not index it essentially to real life? Now, what is the difference between a minimum wage and what's become known as a living wage?
Right. Well, MIT has a living wage calculator where you can go on there and type in where you live, and it'll spew out a number that's based on looking at the cost of local transportation, food, housing, and other basic needs. I looked up the city I live in, the District of Columbia. They said the living wage there was $17 an hour, but that's for full-time work. And I want to point out that a huge additional problem, in addition to the low wages in this country, is the increased insecurity of work. How many people are working part-time at Walmart? It's half of their employees are part-time workers. Then there's the temporary workers and the subcontracted workers. You know, Amazon's $15 an hour is not going to apply to their contractors. So it's the increased precariousness of work that's also a big problem. Despite our low unemployment, we still have so many people working every day for poverty wages.
Paul, even though $15 an hour is twice the current federal minimum, as you mentioned, we heard from a lot of listeners who say in this economic climate, even 15 doesn't go very far. Let's hear from some of them.
We've always had increases to minimum wage to try to make it better for workers, but we never can catch up. It's like a dog trying to catch its tail. When we raise the minimum wage, it's never enough.
As a college graduate with a bachelor's degree and student loans, I already make $15 an hour at a full-time job and have to supplement with at least one part-time job at all times.
I think there needs to be some consideration on regional differences, because I can assure you that $15 an hour in South Carolina goes much further than $15 an hour in California.
I work another job besides my full-time job, and so I am kind of like squeaking by, but unfortunately I have lots of credit card debt as a result. And actually like $18 an hour to $20 for a full-time job would probably be closer to saving my butt.
Now, Paul, we hear from a lot of 1A listeners there who are living on a minimum wage. And for many, many more, this has been a big issue in Congress. Workers who work for big companies can't afford health care, don't have insurance, wind up relying on state or federal public assistance to make up the difference. And that suggests that all of us in some way are subsidizing low wages.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And I mean, you're, and as are your callers. I mean, actually, if you look at cost of living data, you see that in all 50 states, a single worker will need at least $15 an hour to cover the basics in just a couple of years. And in the high-cost states that your listeners were flagging, or workers with children, will need even more than $15 an hour. We have a report on our website by Maya Pinto, P-I-N-T-O, on this with the numbers for all 50 states. And it really highlights how 15 is really a basic national floor, and we need to even go up from there. Like, you know, in New York and New Jersey did this week, where airport workers are getting a raise to $19 an hour, and hotel workers are striking around the country in the higher cost cities demanding $25 an hour. So, you know, your listeners are right about what, you know, as a practical matter, if you do the math, what individuals need to get by, especially in the higher cost regions. And as a result, you know, a lot of employees of companies, big and small, are relying on our taxpayer-funded safety net for support. You know, more than $150 billion a year of safety net programs go to workers in low-paying jobs. And, you know, these are good programs, and we should have them, but we need, you know, major employers to do their part, to pay a decent wage of at least $15 an hour, and then to supplement that with work supports in order to help bring workers up to a basic level.
Now, let's hear some of the other side of this. Seth writes to us on Facebook, "When I worked for Walmart, we were all excited when they raised our wages to $10.50, but then they cut hours to barely 20 hours a week, then told us if we didn't have an open schedule, we would get even less. I'm skeptical of individual companies that are raising wages." And we received also a lot of calls from people who were concerned that raising the federal minimum wage to, say, $15 an hour could wind up backfiring on workers.
I'm all for making, you know, $15 an hour at the job I'm at now. I work at Dick's Sporting Goods in the mall. But I find that a lot of people, or a lot of employers, if they're raising the hourly wage, are just cutting down hours, which in the end, it's either a zero sum from the previous wage, or in some cases, you make less.
I am opposed to raising it to $15 an hour simply because I don't think businesses will take that loss. They will raise the prices, the standard of living will raise, and $15 won't do anyone any good. The poor will stay poor.
Michael Saltzman, you hear the concerns there. It'll raise prices on consumers. They'll just pass it along. Or companies will simply juggle hours to make up the difference. And you might get more per hour, but you get less hours and you don't come out ahead.
Well, I think those are fair concerns. And in fact, it's exactly what we saw happen in Seattle in response to that city's $15 minimum wage experiment, where employees were earning a higher base pay. But a study that was a team of researchers that was supported by the city council found that affected employees were losing about $125 a month on average because of fewer hours. I think the question of living wage versus minimum wage in a lot of ways asks the wrong question. I think the question always in the minimum wage debate comes down to, are customers willing to pay for it? Because if customers were ever and always willing to pay higher prices, we wouldn't even have to have a debate about the minimum wage, because it wouldn't matter if it was 15 or 20 or 25. People would pay for it. But it's because customers are price sensitive, and because companies cannot always raise their prices, that there ends up being this tension between at what point does the minimum wage get to a point where companies have to say, you know what, we're going to have to find a way to provide the same service with fewer people. And maybe some of the conveniences that you're used to are now either things you do yourself or things that are automated instead of being done by a person. And I mean, thank Amazon in a lot of ways with their Amazon Go convenience stores, where there's no lines and no checkouts and no employees, are sort of the perfect embodiment of the risk of raising labor costs too high.
It is true, certainly, companies could just pass on the increase in wages to consumers, and maybe consumers don't want to pay it. But there's profit as well. It doesn't have to come out of consumer prices. I hear that a lot, and it's true. They might raise my prices. But I also hear how much money Amazon made last year and how many, $37 billion Jeff Bezos himself took home. And that makes me say they can keep prices the same and pay people more. Obviously, Amazon agrees. They're doing it.
Well, I think Amazon in a lot of ways is sort of the outlier. And I think if we want to talk about the typical chief executive, a company, according to the BLS, is not making what Jeff Bezos is making. They're making just under $200,000 a year. And so that is not a bad living at all. But if you combine that with companies that are earning, 2 or 3% profit margins and have a very price-sensitive customer base, that's a very different kind of company. And so I think we need to keep that company in mind when we're thinking about, and especially when Amazon is thinking about, whether they want to lobby the federal government on this point. Not every company is Amazon, and not every company is going to be in a position to say, we can pass this on to our customers. And in fact, in a lot of cases we've seen in California, companies have closed down specifically because their customers don't want to pay the higher price.
Sarah Anderson, there have been minimum wage increases in cities and municipalities all across the country, and it's given kind of a good research pool to look at. Now, Michael mentioned Seattle, which is one city that raised the minimum wage. There's been Washington, San Jose, lots of other cities as well. It's given economic researchers a chance to really look at the minimum wage in real life, in the real economy, real workers, and real small businesses. Mm-hmm. I know there are competing studies. We might get into a little bit of left hook, right hook on this. but take the experience that we have now in as big a chunk as you can. Minimum wage goes up 9, 10, 15. What do we know?
Well, let me give a little bit of a right hook here on the Seattle study that Michael cited, which has been widely attacked for having a deeply flawed methodology, leaving out 40% of the local workforce because they did not include companies that had multiple locations, which would include the McDonald's, the Best Buys, the many low-wage employers. There's a recent study that just came out of Berkeley that looks at six cities that have all had significant wage increases. They include many of the ones that you just mentioned. They looked at the experience of food servers, and found that all of the fear-mongering about job losses has not proved true, and wages, of course, have gone up. So these are the arguments we hear time and time again. Any kind of new regulation on businesses is going to result in job losses, increased prices for consumers, and so forth. Take a look at what's going on right now with the huge windfalls that corporations have gotten as a result of the Republican tax cut. Are they using that to lower prices or do something positive? No, they're putting it into increasing CEO pay, massive stock buybacks that are inflating the value of their shares and rewarding their shareholders. So these are the old arguments we hear every time we're trying to have a social advancement that would be good for workers, and they tend to not prove true.
Paul, what's the best that we know now about the sweet spot? Look, if you made the minimum wage $60 an hour, a lot of businesses wouldn't be able to afford that. I get it. But then there's this inflection, right? There's this sweet spot that the place where workers can make the most, that's best for workers and put money in their pockets before you get to the point where it starts to negatively affect a business and they cut hours or cut workers or have some malign effect on the very workers that we would all like to help. At least I presume so. Do we know where the sweet spot is?
I don't think we yet know, but what the evidence, as Sarah has noted, is showing is that the concerns that $15 an hour was too high have the most rigorous emerging new research show that those concerns were not well founded. You know, that Seattle study that got a lot of attention, some of the leading economists that initially had taken notice of it have since backed off and said they no longer find it credible, people like MIT's David Otter. And there's been important new research that's just come out using some of the state-of-the-art methodology published in the Journal of Labor Economics, which is one that's been a lot of plaudits and looked in particular at the U.S. states with the highest minimum wages and found no evidence that jobs have been hurt by as these wages have phased in. But I really think the best evidence is the business press and what we all see on the ground in the cities that are phasing in these higher minimum wages. You know, take New York or D.C. where the participants are right now. New York is phasing in its $15 minimum wage. It's $13 now. We'll go to $15 on New Year's Eve. The restaurant industry is booming, and Crain's New York Business is reporting that the $15 minimum wage is not hurting jobs, and they're in fact growing faster than ever. And the same is true in D.C. And in fact, I know you were going to raise the tipped wage debate a little bit later, but I think what's significant about D.C. is it's phasing in a $15 minimum wage, and despite the debate over tips, the $15 minimum wage is not controversial, and the restaurant industry itself is not making any attempt to attack it. It really, and we see the same in Los Angeles, Chicago, Seattle, the other major cities. Low-wage jobs, jobs in restaurants, retail, the sectors most affected by the minimum wage really are continuing to grow strongly. And the only places they're seeing real raises are where these much higher minimum wages are phasing in.
The comments and questions are pouring in from 1A listeners. Jonathan emails, I currently work for $10 an hour, and with my experience, $15 an hour is closer to a fair amount. It's enough to help cover hidden costs of employment like transportation, fuel costs, repair maintenance for vehicles, tools, clothes, etc. Ryan tweets, you say it's common for a minimum wage employee to get a raise after 12 months, but I work for a chain of auto parts stores and it took 2 years and the raise was a whopping 12 cents. Ryan adds the hashtag fight for 15. And Michael emails, I don't buy that Amazon's decision has anything to do with altruism. I believe Amazon's decision had much more to do with the incredibly competitive job market and its ability to grow its job force in preparation for the holiday season. If they can spin it in a way that makes them look like good guys, well then, good for them. And I think some of our guests might agree with that. Coming up, we have a lot more of your questions and comments about labor and wages today. We're back in a minute. Stay with us.
This message comes from NPR sponsor ADT. America's trusted home security company can help protect you against break-ins, fires, and carbon monoxide. 24/7 emergency response when you need it most. More at ADT.com.
How often do people lie on dating apps? And are robots taking over our jobs? I'm Cardiff Garcia, co-host of Planet Money's The Indicator, where every day we tell you a short story about the economy. Get it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Sarah Anderson, I want to talk about a fight going on in Washington, D.C., where we happen to be in 1A Studios at WAMU.
Center of the world.
Unfortunately, increasingly so, but there has been a very important wage fight going on the local level, not in Washington as the world knows it, but D.C. as locals know it. There was a ballot initiative where voters in D.C. voted to raise the minimum wage for tipped workers, barbacks, bartenders, waiters and waitresses, people who work in restaurants primarily. And there was a big fight, a lot of pushback. It looked like grassroots resistance, and then we found out that a lot of the money for the pushback was indeed coming from organized interests for restaurant owners, the American Restaurant Association, local chapters, and others. Voters voted to say, yes, you have to raise your minimum wage, restaurants, bars. And now the city council here in the District of Columbia has decided that voters were wrong, and they are in the process of voting this very day to overturn the will of local D.C. voters on this issue. What does this fight here in D.C. say about the state of wages, especially for tipped workers, people who might get paid by their employer, I don't know, $5 an hour because they make up the rest in ones and hopefully fives?
The way I see it, this week, the living wage movement took three or four steps forward with the Amazon announcement on 15, and they took one big step back with the DC Council voting to repeal the will of the voters to eliminate in a gradual way this subminimum wage for tipped workers. Federally, the minimum wage for tipped workers is $2.13. It's been stuck there for a couple of decades. Here in D.C., it's $3.89. Technically, if you don't make enough in tips to bring that wage up to the local minimum, your employer is supposed to make up the difference. That pretty much never happens. I used to work in the restaurant industry. I've talked to a lot of restaurant workers. That pretty much never happens. And so we have a workforce of restaurant servers, primarily women, many women of color, a job where people face rampant sexual harassment. They're vulnerable because they're having to do whatever customers say to get those tips, because without the tips, they're back down to really a wage that doesn't amount to anything. So people in the district voted to get rid of this two-tier system. The industry launched an incredible campaign against it. They put posters up everywhere in the city saying, save our tips, to try to make people think that this had something to do with banning tips. It did not. It was clearly beyond a local issue. This was a national showdown between the restaurant industry and people who are trying to get a fair wage for this vulnerable sector of the workforce.
Michael Saltzman, what did you see at play here? I think we're familiar with workers versus management in a fight like this. The D.C. Council voting to overturn the will of the voters is remarkable. But what about the economics of it?
Well, actually, so I think in this case, you had a situation where the interests of workers and management were actually very clearly aligned. I mean, there was a 16-hour hearing before the council voted on this bill to repeal the initiative, Initiative 77. I was at the hearing. I testified at 2:30 in the morning. It went until 3:20 in the morning. And the number of employees who showed up to say, this is going to be harmful to us, you need to repeal this, far outnumbered those who were there to support it. And I just want to take a step back, too. I mean, it was mentioned earlier that a living wage in D.C. is $17 an hour. I mean, tipped employees in D.C., according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, earn with their tips about $18 to $19 an hour. So you have people who are already doing quite well. And what happened a few years ago is that business and labor in D.C. came together and said, okay, we want to go to a $15 minimum wage. And regardless of what you think on the merits of that, we're also going to raise the tipped minimum wage, in that case, up to about $5 an hour. And they did that because they heard from tipped employees who said, we want to keep the tip credit. We want our tips to count as income. There was one group, a New York-based group called ROC, that didn't like that. And so they came in and they had a lot of money that came in to try and put this issue on the ballot. And what happened was, yes, the restaurant industry was opposed to this ballot measure, but you had a massive grassroots outpouring from employees, hundreds of whom showed up, for instance, to an event with Council Chairman Phil Mendelson to say, we don't want this. And I think it's part of a bigger movement of employees.
Now, you say grassroots, and I'm sure that you're right, but grassroots are astroturf. We see so much grassroots in the area of wages and minimum wages, only to find out that the grassroots workers who are fighting against increases in wages are backed by business interests.
Well, so I think that talking point, I think that's been used by proponents is a little bit demeaning to the workers who came forward, because the testimony they gave at 1:45 in the morning, or the people who got up at Franklin Hall and said, you know what, this is going to be harmful to me, this is going to be harmful to my industry. Don't try and save me. I'm not asking for it. I mean, I think that the notion, I think that these people are just doing that because they're sort of put up to it, or somehow that they're not real employees, I think is kind of insulting to what they're trying to do. And Phil Mendelson, Chairman Phil Mendelson, the chair of the DC Council, made an interesting point when he got up to talk about this, which is that he said, I have heard from countless employees who tell me this is not good for them. I have heard from almost nobody who wants to keep it. And he said, people can come to me privately. They can email me. This is not an issue of their owners being intimidated. He said that the grassroots on this in support of it was silent. He called them the silent grassroots. And I think that's indicative of where the passion was on this issue.
All right, let's pull back from the District of Columbia, the local D.C., back out to the nation at large. And so many of you 1A listeners have been reaching out to us. Nina posts on Facebook, I'm in a precarious position. If my wages go up, I won't be eligible for Medicaid, so it's a wash, or worse for me. We talked about free riders and how many workers who get minimum wages wind up on public assistance. And Randy in Tulsa emails, advocates are correct. Amazon, Walmart, McDonald's, and the other giants can afford $15 for a minimum wage, but the local donut shop, the mom and pop florist, those businesses will be hurt. It's just another blow against Main Street. Now, Sarah, I want to talk to you about income inequality and where minimum wage fits into this. We hear so much about the growing wealth gap and massive income inequality in this country. We talk about the shrinking of the middle class, but at the low end of the pay scale, can increases in minimum wage actually provide any real equity, or is it just a drop in the bucket in a world where the top 1% own 50% of the wealth?
It's meaningful, but in some ways it is a drop in the bucket. You know, a couple of years ago, two of my colleagues calculated that the three wealthiest men in America, including Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, Warren Buffett, and Bill Gates, have combined wealth that is greater than the combined wealth of the bottom half of the country. And today, that's an understatement because Jeff Bezos' wealth has increased so much. But nevertheless, it dramatizes just how extreme the wealth gap is. And I think there's a lot of interest in adding to the Fight for 15 efforts to look not just at the low end of the wage scale, but also the top end. What can we do to prevent these really obscene levels of income and wealth concentration at the top that are so damaging to our economy, our democracy, not to mention just just a moral outrage in a country that is so wealthy. And so I'm really excited about a new tool we have for doing this. This year, for the first time in history, publicly held companies have to report the gap between their CEO and their worker pay. The numbers coming out are staggering. At Walmart, it's 1,000 to 1, and at McDonald's, it's 3,000 to 1. And we can build on that information to incentivize companies to narrow their gaps. And just one quick example, Portland, Oregon introduced the world's first tax penalty on companies that pay their CEO more than 100 times their median worker pay this year. They're going to put the revenue from that into homeless services, and it'll hit companies like Wells Fargo and Walmart that do business in the city of Portland. I think ideas like that are going to start to spread like wildfire now that we have this information about gaps within specific companies.
And an interesting set of proposals at a time when populism is strong in our political culture, both on the left and on the right, and workers' voices and income inequality are becoming a much more important part of the conversation. You certainly see a lot of pushback from corporate America. I think Bernie would be down. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in New York would be down.
But there's a strong business argument for this. There's research that shows narrower gaps are good for business, lower turnover rates, raise worker morale. So it's not just people on the left. It's enlightened business leaders who should be behind these kinds of efforts.
Now, Paulson, let me turn it back to you. We got this message from Sarah, who's in North Carolina. Listen.
My concern is I made more money in 1987 than I've been able to find a job in the northeastern North Carolina area at present day. So it kind of is disappointing, upsetting, and frustrating to know that I'm 56 years old and the best I'm ever going to get is probably less than $10 an hour. I have a paralegal degree from Old Dominion University, and the nearest job that I saw was $8 an hour for a paralegal with 5 years' experience. That's horrible.
Paulson, there's Sarah with a professional degree and a bad case of wage stagnation. Even if her wages go up a little bit, her buying power is shot, and she feels like she's treading water.
Yeah, no, I mean, she's exactly right. Of the 1 in 3 U.S. workers struggling on less than $15 an hour, nearly half of them have some college experience, and it really highlights how pay has really gotten stuck in our economy, and there's increasing recognition that we need strong action to begin to jumpstart pay and wages. And you know, a $15 minimum wage, which would raise pay for 1 in 3 workers, would put, once phased in, a total of $3,500 an hour more in the pockets of that 1 in 3 workers. So that's definitely part of the solution, but we need a lot more than that. We need to restore overtime pay to boost incomes for middle wage earners. The Obama administration expanded overtime pay, and a group of Republican attorneys general blocked it, and then the Trump administration abandoned it. But states are moving forward, and we expect to see more states jumping in to give middle class workers an overtime pay raise. But more broadly, there's a growing recognition really in mainstream circles that we need to give workers a greater voice and greater power in our economy to rebalance things and steer more of this booming economy towards families and workers. And so that means restoring a role for unions in our economy and fixing our broken labor law system. And there are a range of other really important proposals emerging about having workers on corporate boards. California just mandated women on all corporate boards, and they were seeing increasing proposals around competition policy and tax policy to create new incentives for companies to invest more of their profits and share more of them with their workforces. I think, if control of Congress shifts and there's a revisiting of the tax code, I think you'll see big incentives for companies to share more with their workers. There's a renaissance in competition policy focusing on how the role of giant companies like Amazon and the other major chains that dominate the economy are holding down pay. And we really need a multi-pronged, all hands on deck approach to begin boosting pay. pay and wages again. And it's exciting that actually there's much more focus and conversation around it. And you know, step one is clearly a $15 minimum wage.
Well, it's a fascinating and precarious state of affairs. It is true that workers are demanding better wages and in a lot of cases getting them. But you said unions should be stronger. They are getting much, much weaker. You said that regulation should start to favor workers and not corporate hegemony. And in fact, the Supreme Court appears to be going in the opposite direction. It's a story that's going to get written over the coming decades. Michael Saltzman, I want to turn to you and big companies like Amazon or Walmart or even some of the states out there. You mentioned the tight labor market. It seems like if you're going to raise wages, that now is the time. I mean, companies are competing for workers. It makes sense to pay better wages when the labor market is so very tight. Is the pressure for better wages going to go away if unemployment goes up? Inevitably, it will. I don't know when.
I don't think it will. I mean, I think it's probably going to it may lessen. But I think that the fundamental question that underpins a lot of this is sort of what is the best way to sort of boost pay at the bottom end of the pay scale. And if right now you have this sort of robust market dynamic, and if that some of that decreases, if the economy takes a turn, then we're going to be having a policy debate about, okay, well, what are other tools we have in our toolkit to raise wages? And I think the concern I think that we have is that that the minimum wage, I think, historically has not only had some of these unintended consequences in terms of reducing number of job opportunities, it also has not been tremendously well targeted to families in poverty. And so we've been really supportive of policies, for instance, like the Earned Income Tax Credit, that boost wages through the tax code instead of through a mandate on employers, and are intended to be much better targeted to the employees who need it, while not having an adverse effect on, for instance, young adults. I mean, I think young adults are often sort of the forgotten party in a lot of these debates. But, you know, if you look at over the last 20 years, youth labor force participation has plummeted as minimum wages have risen. You've had this summer, you had about 11 million teens who still weren't in the labor force. And I think what happens is we sort of look around and say, well, as companies decide, well, we're going to eliminate busboys, as we're going to eliminate people who are bagging groceries, as we're going to eliminate cashiers, what happens to those young people who no longer have that first rung on the job ladder to move up?
We're coming up on the end of the hour. Sarah Anderson, your final thoughts, because this debate is not over.
I want to push back a little bit harder on your suggestion that ideas about restraining CEO pay are just something for the left end of the political spectrum.
Mm-hmm, the Bernies of the world.
Stanford University did a poll that showed 52% of Republicans would put a cap on CEO pay relative to worker pay. That's beyond what I'm calling for today, though, and that's ordinary Republicans. So I think there is tremendous potential here to build a movement across the political spectrum to attack the extreme inequality we're seeing today, to narrow our economic gaps, both by lifting up the bottom, as Amazon took a step forward in doing today, and bringing down the top. And that would be good for everyone.
That's Sarah Anderson, director of the Global Economy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and co-editor of Inequality.com. Sarah, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Joining us for this discussion on the minimum wage across America, Michael Saltzman, Managing Director for Employment at the Employment Policy Institute. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
And Paul Son, thanks to you, State Policy Program Director at the National Employment Law Project. Thanks, Paul.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, remember, you can subscribe to 1A's podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you like. We'd love it if you would write us a review. If you're new to podcasts, you'll find all the links to listen online at npr.org/1A. The show is produced by Stephanie Collette. I'm Todd Zwillick. This comes to you from WAMU and NPR. Thanks for listening.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the NPR Wine Club. Discover hand-selected wines from around the world, learn the stories behind each one, and enjoy unique bottles inspired by favorite NPR shows. If you're 21 or older, uncork a special offer at nprwineclub.org.